It's Black Country Week. We've had him in for Ian. I've had to point out to my next guest that I'm not anywhere near as charming or as good looking as Ian, but I'm sure that we can make do for the next 49 minutes and then dance here after midday. And then second part of my job today is off to do commentary on the pre-season friendly for the Brooks Clark Trophy between Hals Owington and Stourbridge at the Grove. So come down and say hello and throw things at us or whatever you want to do between 2 and 6. Gary Manderson in the chair here, and I'll be down at the Grove with an assorted plethora of people to talk to. So listen in or come and join us directly. They're expecting about 1,000 people there today, and all raising money for cancer research. So the buckets will be out aplenty around the ground this afternoon. Please bring some cash with you and put whatever you can into those buckets, because it is obviously for a good reason. Now, pleased to welcome, because I've not met him before, let alone spoken to him before, Marco Longhi, who's the MP for Dudley North. Morning, Marco. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Adam, and good morning, everybody.
Let's catch you off guard to a certain extent and start with sport. And a certain boxer this morning who won a gold medal.
Yes, isn't that great news? I just learnt about it about an hour ago, and it's I'd already sent him a good luck message the other day when he made it to the final, and I've already tweeted my congratulations to him. Isn't it fantastic?
Well, we seem to have done fantastic, full stop, considering we were all a bit nonplussed beforehand.
Absolutely, and I have to say, you know, when we're doing better than whatever organisation they call themselves as Russia and Australia, which traditionally just, you know, really take, you know, haul the medals in, I'm just amazed, you know, and it's a fantastic achievement for Team GB, and it certainly makes me proud to be British, and it's great to see the Union Jack flying on that podium all of the time. It's brilliant.
I must admit, from my perspective, as long as we finish above Australia and the medals table, that's all that I'm worried about. But yeah, it's been a strange old Olympics. I don't know if you caught much of it. I haven't watched as much as I would normally do, but again, it's a bit like the football without supporters last season. It was it's been a little bit eerie, but at the same time, very entertaining. And in the same respect, you know, I suppose things are improving in this country, because we had West Bromwich Albion in action last night and in front of a big crowd down at Bournemouth. So it's nice, at least things in this country are starting to improve.
Yeah, it's been a strange Olympics, and it's been a strange year and a half for all of us. And you can just imagine how difficult it's been for all of these athletes to train. So all credit to them for what they're achieving. And obviously, with the Olympics being in Japan and the time zones affecting us so badly, what you're relying on is on broadcasters to be able to show us when they know that everybody's at home. And although I must say I am a bit of a critic of the BBC, and this is perhaps a bit of a criticism I must level at them here again, because I'm finding that what their programmes are, of an evening, you know, you get home, you have your tea, you switch the TV on, and what you want to do is see how well Team GB has done and look at how other countries are performing with the medals. And all you'll get is the odd clip, and then you're hearing about individual athletes' problems they might have had or issues, and it becomes a program about something else. And I really want to learn about what's going on track and field, even if it's not Team GB, you know. It's been a strange broadcasting choice, I think, from the BBC in some respects.
I'm going to carry on down that road, if you don't mind. Do you think the BBC has become a bit of a box-ticking corporation?
Oh, dear me. I can see where you're going with this. Absolutely. And more. I've been a very harsh critic of the BBC. In fact, if you were to ask me if I support the campaign to defund the BBC, I'd say absolutely yes. The BBC has completely lost its way. I think it's gone beyond the point of no return. I could see some changes happening 10, 15 years ago. But you'd put it down to the odd individual presenter, if you like, for having particular views. But, you know, I've worked across the globe. I remember working in the Amazon jungle, and I got my own little radio high frequency that was able to pick up the BBC World Service. And it was absolutely fabulous to be able to maintain that connection between home, if you like, via the BBC. And the BBC certainly at the time, had a fantastic brand and reputation for well-researched journalism, being completely impartial. And I'm afraid I'm just not able to say that about the BBC anymore. You know, what they've done to pensioners with the licence fee, what they did during the run-up to the Brexit referendum, and how completely one-sided they were with that. You know, it's just two shocking examples of how they're doing. The other day, Woman's Hour came up with talking about age-appropriate pornography, and I'm thinking, what? Where is the BBC going? You know, it's the one of the bastions of the whole woke agenda at the moment, and it's just not something for me. You know, and I think that, you know, if you're actually producing programs and you're not being completely impartial, and you're producing those programs on the back of what effectively is a tax, it's a public service more than any other. A broadcaster, because no other broadcaster is funded through taxpayers' money in that way, then I think they're letting people down. And I think there are, you know, young and old who are deserting the BBC now and not paying the licence fees. And it'll come as no surprise to me whatsoever if the next thing that you hear from the BBC is that they're in financial difficulties.
How do you think things should happen? Do you think the BBC should... Well, you say be defunded. Should it become a subscription channel or something like that? And then you pay for, you know, the high quality dramas or whatever that they produce?
Well, you have several examples out there in terms of how people either produce, you know, TV and radio. And the thing about it is that it's an open competition, isn't it? You know, the BBC doesn't have to compete in that same way because it knows it's getting year on year so many millions of pounds from the people who pay the licence fee. And, you know, I just cannot accept that you've got broadcasters like Gary Lineker earning whatever it is, £1.5 million, and then we say no to free TV licences for our older generation who went to war for us. You know, it's just completely unacceptable. And by the way, you know, if we're going to talk about Gary Lineker, use their platform as a sort of a celebrity broadcaster to then make political comments, which he did, you know, over Brexit. You know, and I just thought it was completely out of order. The BBC didn't deal with it. And that's another thing. If you ever complain to the BBC these days, it's judge and jury. You might as well forget about complaining to the BBC. I've complained a couple of times, and the whole process is so difficult to get through, and then you just end up with a result which is, we're just going to not do anything about it, and that's it. And if you try and complain to Ofcom, well, they just recycle BBC directors. You know, it's something that I do hope the government will look at in the not too distant future. It's had so much to deal with. The government of late, and of course the BBC does have a royal charter, which will expire only in a few years' time. So, if you like, they're safe until then. But there's going to be a review of the BBC charter, and I think they will be shocked when they see what comes out of it.
Well, the royal charter, as you rightly say, gets reviewed every so many years.
Yeah,
and you probably know as well as I do that as long as we've been watching the BBC or listening to the BBC, hardly anything has changed. In fact, they've probably been allowed to get away with what they've wanted to continuously, despite governments saying, we'll review. The fact is, you can review all you like. If you don't implement anything new, nothing will ever change. But you can see it going in one particular direction. That's been the case for a number of years. You almost feel that government should be putting a brake on it, but what's wrong, I guess, is the fact that even government seems powerless to do anything about it.
Well, of course, the charter is in place, and you can't overturn a charter mid-term. That is my understanding. So the review will inform what happens when the next charter is to be reappointed, if you like, and given again back to the BBC. I mean, I just hope that we come up with a completely different funding model for the BBC, so there's a level playing field in terms of competition with other broadcasters, and they then completely reconsolidate their product offer. Because if you look what the offerings online, streaming, radio, and TV channels, it's no wonder that they're spending money hand over fist. It's just way too much. And then they're not moving forward with the times either. You know, let me restate this. I've always been a huge champion of the BBC, and what I see happening right now breaks my heart. And if the BBC were to turn round and completely address all of the concerns I've mentioned to you and many more that more eloquent colleagues of mine could put forward, then I turn back and support the BBC. But you know what's happening right now is something that I could not accept. And if there were to be a vote in Parliament, I think you know which way I'd vote.
And I think the fact of the matter is the BBC is supposed to broadcast to all demographics, not one particular part. Hence I take your point in the way things are going. Do you feel that Sky News is independent in the way, I mean, they advertise themselves as being the independent news channel?
I'm not really sure how to answer that question.
Or perhaps more independent than the BBC?
Perhaps more. All I can say is that you will survive as a broadcaster if you have viewers, and viewers will carry on watching your programmes if they have confidence that it reflects their views. And I think that the BBC will soon find out that, I'm sure they know already, that people are just walking away in their thousands, if not the millions.
There just seems to be a slant towards trying to perhaps bring youth back on board, in the respect that I see things like BBC Four being talked about closing down and BBC Three reopening up as a terrestrial channel, which sort of, as somebody of my age, I think, well, hang on, I like BBC Four programmes, and what is there to cater for my taste, and I'm paying my licence fee. I don't want to turn this into a conversation about my viewing habits or whatever, but I think there is certainly, they're trying to be, I suppose, a jack of all trades, but not really getting it right, are they?
They're not getting it right, no, which is why I think, you know, it ultimately comes down to senior management there, doesn't it? And they really do need to take one hard look at their strategic direction and how they've dealt with all of the complaints that have come in and accusations of lack of impartiality. Principally, you know, a lot of politicians came out of this feeling incredibly bruised. The nation spoke at Brexit time and told organisations just like the BBC, don't treat us like fools. We know what we want. You know, and for the country to have delivered on a Brexit vote the way it did, having had the BBC, the main channel, if you like, lots of Sky as well, and not to mention Channel 4, of course, completely against the whole Brexit agenda and not being impartial over it. And then the whole machinery of Whitehall and government, I think it was amazing that, you know, I see the people of this country and the people of Dudley came to the rescue of democracy and had to sort it out because politicians and establishments couldn't do it for themselves. And, you know, I'm just so... I am here as a Member of Parliament for Dudley as a result of that, you know, and I'm so proud to be here. It's an immense privilege.
Brexit has sort of gone out the headlines because of COVID over the last year and a bit. Has it worked, in your opinion?
It is working, and it is work in progress. There were, you know, you could have interviewed someone like me, not that the BBC would have ever chosen to interview me, of course, but there were always going to be bumps along the way. And, of course, part of the agreement that was reached between the European Union and Britain is that both parties should work to best endeavours. And best endeavours mean that you do your best to achieve a stated outcome. And everything that we've seen from the European Union since we had the agreement is quite the opposite. So, for example, if you take Northern Ireland, who I will fight for staunchly because I'm a very strong unionist, we are one country, they are insisting effectively on treating Northern Ireland as a separate annex to the United Kingdom. So they are trying to dictate what products and services can be bought and sold between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. And now, which sovereign country in their right mind would actually say, well, that's that we are one country under those terms? That just doesn't work, does it? You know, and they are insisting on product checks to the nth degree, whereas dozens of other countries that border with the rest of the European Union don't have those checks. They don't insist them at all. They are much more based on trust, and they are much more based on the practicalities, but they are showing none of that goodwill as far as Northern Ireland is concerned. And of course, what is actually happening here is they want to make it fail. They want to use the United Kingdom as an example to other EU countries who may be considering exiting from the EU, and they are there, but they're just afraid to speak up. And that what they want to do is, if you like, punish the United Kingdom for having voted that way. And I'm sorry, they've got something coming if they think they're going to bully us.
Were we wrong to sign up to the agreement in the first place?
No, I don't think so. Because what became completely obvious is that it was a stepping stone. And there were going to be, as I say, best endeavours from both parties. And you just simply can't sort everything out of that magnitude and that complexity in one shot. And I think that by going forward at the time and saying, well, yes, let's sort out this other stuff at some later point in time, was the right approach. So if you like, it's a transition. That's why you had a transition period of 1 year. Mm-hmm. You know, you just simply can't achieve everything at the flip of a switch. And the signing of a piece of paper.
Was it not the case that that transition year was almost like people who were using that and indeed companies were, it's almost like putting your fingers in your ear and going, la, 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 we don't want things to change. And perhaps it wasn't until, you know, very late on in the piece that people thought, oh, hang on, we better do something about this, things are changing.
I'm not sure whether I'd describe it in those terms for business as a whole. I think some businesses have been fantastic.
Well, perhaps a lot of smaller businesses would have looked at it and thought, yeah, well, you know, this is more, I find it hard enough running a day-to-day small business without having Brexit thrown at me as well.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, the government has put in place, you know, put in an enormous effort to and advertised a lot as well, the kind of support that businesses, the kind of things that businesses needed to do, and the support was there for them. But some of them took up that support and were more proactive. Others were perhaps more in denial, and maybe these might have been the business owners who perhaps voted Remain. I don't know. But anyway, it's we're going to take some time, more time, and we will work this out. And I've got, you know, I'm incredibly impressed with Lord Frost, who is guiding the United Kingdom in terms of developing our future relationship with the EU.
But do you see the agreement being broken by our government because of this Northern Ireland situation?
I think everything is on the table. Absolutely. If you remember, the EU invoked, I think it was Article 16, and broke it almost immediately within a few weeks of the agreement being signed. Mm. You know, and that was completely out of order. It showed you, by way of example, what the EU's attitude is to the United Kingdom. They said it was a mistake afterwards. They said it, but it was actually symptomatic of the whole EU establishment and how they, particularly the EU Commission. When I say the EU establishment, it's really the Commission mostly I'm talking about, and a lot of the European members of Parliament, although they are really powerless. It's all of the power is with the Commission. It's an unelected. I don't even want to call it a democracy. Really, it's the Commission has the power. The MEPs always just basically say yes to what the Commission says. They have five presidents in the EU, and I've never understood how that happens. But anyway, there you go. Can't even name them anymore.
But do you think at some point the EU will disband?
I think that the long-term Project EU, as people like Guy Verhofstadt like to see it, is doomed to failure. And, of course, what they saw with the UK exiting is an acceleration of that process. Mm-hmm. Let's see what happens. My focus now isn't on the EU. My focus is on delivering more jobs for the people of this country, which we will achieve through trade agreements with other countries. And Liz Truss, the Secretary of State, has done an absolute amazing job, not only signing up to free trade agreements as continuity agreements with what the EU had previously with other countries, but she's gone way beyond that. For example, Japan, where we've got the Olympics now, we've got fantastic opportunities, and it's for the whole of the United Kingdom. You know, so we've opened up markets in for example, the United States, where they'd banned beef and nothing was happening about changing that. That's changed now. We're selling Scottish whiskey across the planet like no tomorrow because of the trade agreements that we've signed up to, and it'll be through trade that we'll get more jobs, not just more jobs, but more safe and secure jobs. Because a lot of people are in work and they're worried about whether they're still going to be having it in 6, 12, 18 months' time. And by business being more successful, which is obviously what I'm trying to promote, everybody will be more secure in their way of life.
Okay, that sounds a little bit like a party political broadcast, but I take on board what you're saying.
You know, what else do you want me to say?
No,
what I genuinely believe. You know, and that isn't off some script, as you can see. I'm just speaking to you off the cuff here.
Tell me about Marco Longhi the person. Because, you know, people have voted for you and might not necessarily know much about you. They perhaps have voted for you because of Boris Johnson, because they wanted a Conservative government. Just for those that don't know much about you, perhaps a little bit of background.
Okay, black country lad, born in Walsall. My mother met an Italian whilst on holiday in Italy. Hence, my name is Marco, as opposed to Mark. My dad did very quickly find a job in Italy, which meant that I actually grew up and did my education in Italy. All of my family are over here, by the way. You know, mm-hmm. My father, and yeah. So I was always the English guy over there, but because he worked for the National Airline, we got these very, very cheap tickets. I remember flying standby all the time, but sometimes not being able to catch the plane, but for very little money, I was able to come back and spend time with my English family, with whom I was much, much closer, particularly my grandfather, who became the mayor of Warsaw in 1976, I believe it was. Little did I know when I was 12 years old delivering these leaflets door-to-door for him, I hadn't got a clue what was going on, obviously, but that I'd be doing the same myself. And actually, I became the mayor of Warsaw back in 2017, following in my grandfather's footsteps. How would I describe myself to people? Well, I mean what I say, and I say what I mean. And, you know, if you can look a black country person in the eye and see through his soul, if you like, then you've got them on your side. I'm not the type of politician who will just say something just to get through the next difficult time, next question, please. I try and answer the question to the best of my knowledge. And if I can't, I'll always say, I need to come back to you, mate. I just don't know. Mm. You know, so...
How do you find the people of the black country? Because obviously...
The best.
No doubt they want to throw questions at you right, left and centre.
Salt of the earth. They're my kind of people. I'm one of them. Even though I've had an international upbringing, I chose to come back to the black country. And live here. I mean, I worked in South America in oil and gas for 5 years. Mm-hmm. My wife is Brazilian. We speak Portuguese at home, so the girls were brought up with English and Portuguese without really having to learn it, as it were. But, you know, I'll switch from Italian to Portuguese to yam-yam, although some people say I don't do it very well. That's probably because I've just lived in so many different
circumstances
and countries and in different ways. But a close friend of mine once said to me, Marco, I've really thought long and hard about you. What is your USP? And this is like before I was even selected to become an MP. What is your USP? And I said, oh, mate, I don't know. I said, I've got lots of experience. I'm an engineer. I've had to fight. I certainly didn't have a silver spoon. Everything I've got now is I've had to fight for it. And I've had my own business. I've had to close my own business. I've bought, I've sold, I've employed people. I've been through the whole thing that I think makes me an example of someone with experience now in Parliament, but also a genuine true voice. And he says, Mark, you know what? I think your main USP is authenticity. Mm-hmm. People will talk to you and look you in the eye and they'll say, yeah, he's genuine. I might not agree with him all the time, but he's genuine, and he means what he says.
And do you find that with your constituents, as they sort of approach you and sort of see you? I suppose that we ought to be asking them that question rather than you, but are you sort of a very open person and happy to take on any opinions and comments without perhaps sort of shouting them down or whatever?
Absolutely. Well, you do have to ask them, and don't forget, I've only been an MP for a year and a half, and the majority of that I've had to work from home because working under lockdown. The people who probably know me better are the people I represented previously when I was a councillor. So I was a councillor for 22 years in a ward called Pelsall, where I've got extremely fond memories. Former mining community, again, salt of the earth people, and the kind of people who, you know, I've had, if I could have a pound for every time someone came to me and said, Marco, I've always voted Labour all my life, but I'm voting for you. And at a general election, I might vote a different way, but I'm voting for you because I've seen how hard you've tried for us here in Pelsall. And together with my colleagues, it's obviously not just myself, we've achieved some great things for that community. It's still a village, but it's actually got all the sort of modern amenities that you might expect for even in a town centre. So yes, fond memories of Pelsall people. If any of you are listening, I miss you loads, and I was never really offered the opportunity to say goodbye properly because of COVID.
Yeah.
So maybe you're offering me this opportunity now.
Absolutely.
Miss you tremendously. You've formed me as a person in politics. I think that when you're able to learn your politics at the coalface, where it really truly matters for people, I think you're likely to perform better in representing people when you become a member of parliament. And now I would say that, wouldn't I?
Mm-hmm.
I've got some fantastic colleagues who didn't follow that journey, and I hold in great esteem. But for me, that was the best journey.
Pelsall's like a separate little world on its own, isn't it? It is how you describe it. It is like a village community.
Absolutely.
But it has changed so much over the years as well.
It has, and over 22 years, I was together with my colleagues. I was part of that change, and it's improved immensely. But one of the things we did do is to fight hand over fist to try and maintain that village aspect, and they still call it the village now. A few years ago, I tongue in cheek started to call it the Principality of Pelsall. Not sure what that made me, but
I actually think it's in Wales rather than anything else. Okay, MP now.
Yep.
I don't want to talk about party policies and things like that.
Okay.
I want to talk about what Marco Longhi can bring to Dudley North that's different, that's away from your normal party politics. What do you want to do for this area to improve it?
Oh, there is so much to do. I think that what I will bring is obviously my unique way of conducting my politics. I care deeply about people, and whichever way they voted or whether they don't vote at all, anybody who contacts me for help, me or any member of my team, they will get exactly the kind of service from me, unchanged, and it has to be always 100%. All of my team, you know, I had to employ a small team of people. You know, every member of parliament does that. You know, I can get as many as 200 to 300 messages a day, really. It's a big ask, and I get an enormous amount of inquiries that I would perhaps ordinarily expect councillors to receive. And what I've said to my team is instead of just firing it off to a councillor, because obviously that was a residence choice to do in the first place.
How does the number of emails compare, you know, from councillor to an MP? You say 300 as an MP, how many would you have got, say?
Far fewer, of course. I mean, as a councillor representing what, approximately 10,000 people, as an MP I'm representing 62,000 people, soon to be 72,000 people.
Yeah.
So it's a huge ask. But I think one of the big challenges that that's on my radar is the regeneration of the town centre. Now, the government has poured effectively about £1 billion into Dudley.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the new Institute of Technology, with the £25 million that went into the town's fund board, and you know, announcing the establishment of a university campus there,
mm-hmm.
With the new Flood Street. What do you call it? The centre for, you know, where you can go exercise and
whatever. Gym, yeah.
Gym and whatever. Leisure facility,
yeah.
That's what I'm looking for. The very light rail that we're going to be piloting. We're going to be a pilot for the rest of the country there, with the extension of the metro.
Mm-hmm.
But if you think about it, all of this is happening around the Castlegate area.
Mm.
You know, when I became MMP, we were able, with Andy Street's help and coordination with the council, to bring down Cavendish House.
Yeah.
They'd spoke 15 years about bringing it down. So
yeah.
This government is backing seats like Dudley like never before.
Mm-hmm.
What I want, we have a new cabinet member for regeneration now. I like the guy, Councillor Simon Phipps. What I want to do is really work with him, and we've got a huge task ahead, because all of that investment is around the Castlegate area.
Mm-hmm.
If you start walking up the high street, you see empty market stalls, clothes shops, betting shops and takeaways. And this has been something that's been in the making for the last 15, 20 years. Now, I don't want to blame Dudley and Dudley's regeneration team in particular over that, because go to any other high street and you'll find something similar. And you and I both are probably to blame for that, because we'll all of us sit down in front of our laptops and use the internet to mm-hmm. buy either a washing machine or the groceries from the local supermarket. Most of us have changed our habits in terms of the way we buy. We don't go out, touch, feel and smell. Actually, we might even do that sometimes and then still go home once we've made our choice and order it on the internet, because we might get it that bit cheaper and delivered to our doorstep. So that needs to change, and we need a master plan for the town centre, which I'm really pushing the regeneration team to come up with. I was really quite shocked that there wasn't one. Particularly, where I'd like to see us start isn't just the high street, but the top end of the high street, you know, around Top Church and that particular area. It is desperate for some strategic intervention there. But what I don't want to do is just put some money in without thinking how it might affect the rest of the high street. So we've got a big magnet for activity and investment at the bottom end, well, with Castlegate, if you like, and we've got nothing to attract people through the high street, which I want to create another magnet at the top. So we need a plan to develop that.
Does Dudley need to be a city in order to do that?
No, of course it doesn't need to be a city. And I would like the regeneration team's efforts to focus on exactly the sort of things I've spoken about. I mean, if I look at what's happened with Walsall Market and I compare it to what's happened with Dudley Market, they're very similar.
Mm,
you know, you
yeah.
used to be able to... Well, you hadn't used to be able to walk in a straight line on Dudley Market, likewise in Walsall now.
Mm.
You can, and it's hard pushed to bump into someone, and you walk past a stall after stall that's empty, you know, and it's incumbent on the council and the regeneration team to change that. The government is willing to put the money in, but it'll only do so if it can justify it on that basis. Now, in terms of city status, yes, I do support it, but we need to get all the other stuff right as well. City status will definitely, if we are successful, put us on the map for inward investment, particularly overseas investment, I might say, who people, you know, you can just imagine perhaps a Qatari investor who might be thinking where to pour some of their billions worth of dollars and say, okay, well, you know, what's happening in Dudley? Oh, yes, Dudley, this, that, there's potential, they're going to regenerate the whole area, blah, blah, blah. So what is it? Yeah, oh, it's a town. What? I don't want to talk about towns, I want to talk about cities. Because their perception is that cities are the place to be. So if we could get that badge, now, ordinarily, you can only be a city if you've got a cathedral, as you probably know. But because it's the Queen's Jubilee coming up, the Queen can grant a town city status. So I'm fully behind it. Nothing negative can come from it. But what we do need to do, address those issues that are holding Dudley back, whether we become a city or not. So that's where my focus is.
Is Dudley, as a town stroke city, too disjointed in the respect that you've got the market and the shops are in one part, and then you've got Castlegate and everything that's down there, and indeed the Backcountry Living Museum, you know, over half a mile away? Does that help his case, or is it...
It doesn't help his case, and this is why I'm banging on about having a master plan.
Mm.
You need to connect all of these places up. You need to have them so that you haven't got a place sort of like the top end of the high street now.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all your shiny new buildings and activity and all the money that perhaps students might bring if they come to the university once it's built and all the rest of it.
But you've also got the Hippodrome lying dormant, slap bang between the two.
Yeah, and that's been a really tough call. That's something I inherited, as you can imagine. Mm. And it's been a really difficult one for me as well, because you effectively have very polarised views over the Hippodrome. My position is that Dudley really deserves to have a theatre.
Mm-hmm.
I do love my heritage buildings and old buildings, and I would have liked to have found a way to make it work. And I failed in that endeavour. I'll be quite brutal and honest about it. But I think that the various parties involved didn't help themselves either, because when I was asked to sort of become involved with the Hippodrome, you'd got some very entrenched views at the council,
mm-hmm.
and some very entrenched views with the Friends group, and I could tell that it was very difficult to actually to get the two to talk in a way that could have potentially produced a different outcome. I tried my best. It didn't work. We have a decision now. The council owns the building. It owns the freehold on it in which it sits. And it's made a decision. It's made a decision that was long overdue.
Mm-hmm.
It's been left to rot, and it's been a sad spectacle to watch, even for the small time I've been here in Dudley. You know, mm-hmm. So I think we need to move forward now, and hopefully, you know, I don't buy the argument that, you know, well, we've got a place in the council, you know, the town hall, and use that as a theatre. That's not a dedicated theatre. You know, one of the things that we are fantastically good at in this country in particular is our creative arts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you look at film production, if you look at theatre production, if you look at everything, we have the top performing people and production people on the planet, you know. And so I think having a theatre is very, very important.
But as part of
how that happens and how it works and how it's sustainable on its own two feet and where it's located isn't something that I can just simply wave a magic wand and say, oh, that's how it's going to be and that's how it's going to happen.
But as part of a master plan, if Dudley did get city status and had more money to regenerate, as it were, would you be happy to see like a reincarnation of the Hippodrome, but a new build, and have it similar size to the Hippodrome in Birmingham, for example?
Potentially, yes, absolutely. But that master plan then becomes something very, very big. You know, I think you could have it there conceptually as an idea, but if you're going to bring in a business that's going to run it, and of course a business is going to want to run it profitably,
mm-hmm.
then you need to see that business plan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, particularly if you're going to ask Dudley taxpayers, who at the moment are finding it difficult to see GPs and will complain about the state of the roads and other things, you know. So there's so much that needs to change in Dudley, and I think that we need to at least have a plan that tells us and justifies. So, for example, if you've got a master plan, you can, you know, right now, the way it works with business applications, if you like, planning applications, is that you are granted categories. So, for example, if you are a business selling furniture, if you close the furniture business down, there will be other types of businesses that might sell completely different products, and you wouldn't have to change the planning use for it.
Would you like to keep primarily the buildings and the architecture in the town centre pretty similar, but perhaps have a modern link down to Castlegate, so it all feels as one? Of course, you're going to lose certain buildings. We've talked about the Hippodrome, for example. But surely you've got to have a mixture of the old and the new in any master plan.
Yes, and when you look at the new Institute of Technology, it's like clearly a very modern building
up
the road. You know, we'll have the very light rail building, which I'm sure will be modern. You know, so you need to bring innovation, new skills, new technologies into town. What you want is also the education facilities to make sure that those people who do get those degrees then actually stay in Dudley and don't go somewhere else. This has been part of the issue that I've had, if you like, even with the Towns Fund, because all of the money, the Towns Fund is for the town, but it's going into one place only, which is the university campus. Now, I'm not saying we shouldn't do the university campus, but, you know, the conversations that were being had at the time were all about it being focused around healthcare. Now, if it's healthcare with AI, you know, artificial intelligence, and all of the technologies and university degrees for that, then great. But if all we're going to be doing is having a university that perhaps has nursing students who will then choose to go and work somewhere else, then what is the benefit to Dudley? So these are questions to which I've not had straight answers to yet. So I'm happy to support it, but I'm also going to be asking questions about, you know, the direction of travel and what's going to be actually in there and how we're going to develop it further.
And I'm sure there's also going to be your constituents in the likes of Cowley and Sedgley and wherever who will say, well, what's in it for us?
Oh, completely, yes. And which is why I'm saying, you know, yes, the Towns Fund is for the town, but, you know, what's in it for us? Well, you might have a son and daughter who might be happy to go to a local university rather than one very far away. That might cost you an awful lot more money.
But you also appreciate that there'll be families in more poorer areas who perhaps, you know, that won't happen to. And we spoke about regeneration much earlier in the interview, who want to see more being done to these suburb areas within Dudley Metropolitan Borough.
You mentioned Sedgley. I mean, every time at the end of an afternoon, evening, and you try and drive into Sedgley down that road, it's just like the traffic is chronic. You know, so I'd like to see investment into how you reduce that. You know, I think at some point there used to be talk of a bypass onto the Birmingham New Road, but those things haven't happened. You know, so. Yeah, I completely get it and understand when people might say, well, what about us? And this is why people voted for change, you know. People voted for Brexit, absolutely, but they voted also for a government and expect change. And I think most reasonable people will understand that change doesn't happen, you know, in 5 minutes.
What about to those constituents who think that change just never happens and it's job tends to be jobs for the boys and you know...
I completely understand.
A lot of people can talk the talk, but not necessarily walk the walk.
Yes, and I've seen a lot of that in my time in politics. But it's incumbent on me, it's incumbent on elected politicians of the council to change that. You know, so yes, I completely understand why people would say that, in, you know, and there being a lot of cynicism about. But what am I supposed to do as a politician? Am I supposed to say, yeah, okay, fair enough, and just walk away? Or am I supposed to say, well, let's look at this glass half full instead of half empty and try and be positive and accentuate the positive we've got, understand where we have problems, but address those problems through honest conversations? Now, I think... you know, when people deal with Marco, you ask me, what is Marco? What's Marco like? People sometimes don't know quite how to take me because I will come out and say something that might be occasionally unexpected. And I think that's part of me just being genuine, me saying it as it is. And I think that people have voted for that kind of change as well. They want people to actually say it as it is and not try and hide behind words, hide behind process, hide behind the fact that stuff takes a long time. Now, yes, I've said that stuff takes a long time, but given the chance, what I want to do is bring about change. Now, I hope most reasonable people understand that, you know, in some circumstances, it's like pushing water uphill. And you've got institutions that have been there in the making for decades, and you don't change them overnight. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's about everybody and their jobs and how they might have been used to conducting themselves.
So I know there's this expectation that the MPs should perhaps be able to pull strings and make things happen and do a Paul Daniels and bring something out of the hat. how much are your hands tied by bureaucracy and other things that you can't implement what you'd like to implement?
Most things that local people will want changing, if we're brutally honest about this, actually relate to the sort of thing you might expect a council to deliver. So there are council services.
Mm-hmm.
There are other things that I feel very hot under the collar about and I've been very open about in the past and on my posts on Facebook, for example, illegal immigration. It's clearly got nothing to do with the council. And it's on stuff like that that, you know, Priti Patel will know where I stand with that and many other Red Wall MPs. We've done a lot, but a lot more needs to be done because clearly what we've done so far hasn't been enough. And I think there is an acknowledgement by Priti and others that more needs to be done. As far as I'm concerned, you know what? I'd be having Border Force, if not even the Royal Navy, intercepting these boats and taking them back to France. Now, I mentioned that to a civil servant not very long ago, and he, you know, their jaw dropped, the look on their faces. Oh, but it might cause an international incident. And I looked him in the eye and I said, bring it on. So what? You know, we've paid the French all of this money and they've not delivered. And who in their right mind, you know, I have to say, ever thought the French were going to really help us out with this? You know, I wouldn't have been one of those that would have signed up to pay.
So why has it been done then?
Sorry?
Why has Priti Patel given all this money to France?
Well, maybe she has information that I don't have. I saw a post by Chris Philp, one of her ministers, who I've got a lot of time for. I have to say, by the way, I support Priti Patel and Chris. I think they are ideally suited to do that job. If it weren't for them, we wouldn't even be where we are now with legislation that we've brought forward to stop a lot of those sorts of things. So, for example, giving lifetime in prison sentence to people smugglers if we get them. By the way, something that Labour Party voted against. You know, so we've come through, we've legislation now, but the legislation has to be absolutely right. Tony Blair and I think it was a minister called Barbara Roche at the time embedded across all services that councils have to provide through legislation, enormous amount of human rights legislation, probably because of the fact that he was married to who he was married to, but anyway, to unpick that takes an enormous amount of time from a legal perspective, because what you've got right now is lefty lawyers who will just go after anything. And when Priti was able to fill a plane full of people, for example, to you know, rapists and drug smugglers, for example, back to Jamaica not that long ago, you'd got Labour MP after Labour MP and lefty lawyers who managed to actually take some of these people off the aircraft.
Mm.
You know, and Labour are always on the side of these people. Let's be absolutely clear about this. You know, and this is one of the reasons I also believe people have changed their voting pattern. So they're keener to see these people walking around the streets of the West Midlands instead of the streets of the West Indies. And that's not right. It was actually a Labour politician who gave the Secretary of State the power that if you've got someone who's come into this country through an immigration process, that if they commit serious crime, they should be deported.
Mm-hmm.
But you've got Labour MP after Labour MP queuing up, writing letters, Facebook posts, condemning the government when they do exactly that.
Mm-hmm.
They can't have it both ways, can they?
It's a problem which I fear is going to remain not just this summer, but next summer, probably several summers into the future.
I'm confident we're going to sort it. I'm confident we're going to sort it. I'm asking people to give us time to sort it.
Okay. Time will tell. We'll keep
it. And what's the alternative, by the way?
Well, as you said yourself, keep an open mind and take everybody's views on board. We're completely out of time, Marco. 50 minutes has absolutely flown by. Thank you for being open and honest with your answers and for talking to us this morning. Look forward to chatting again in
the
future.
Nice to meet you, Adam, and thank you for everyone for listening, and we'll do this in a few weeks' time, I guess.
Absolutely, it'll be good fun.
This is a Black Country Radio podcast.